or told me to pass out all my ammunition to the other troops because I was going back to Anhedeli for Bangkok on R&R. I had just got that done when he came back and said, "Bungum, there are no more choppers going that way today, so get your ammo back. You go with us today." I didn't get all my ammo back, just 18 rounds. Now Bungum's lunch was cut short. Lieutenant Herrick loped back from his meeting with Captain Heron and shouted, "Saddle up and follow me. We're moving up." Platoon Sergeant Carl Palmer, 39 years old, a native of Pelham, Georgia, married and a veteran of the Korean War, got the four squads formed up and moving out through the elephant grass. Captain Heron recalls, "The lead platoons moved out smartly and I followed with my radio operators and my artillery observer, Lieutenant Bill Riddle. I planned to tie in with the rear of Al Devney's platoon and had to stop to establish good radio contact with Moore's headquarters." While Heron was doing that, his other two rifle platoons passed by his location on the western edge of the creek bed. Because of that pause, Heron would be cut off from his men for the next hour or so. Al Devney's first platoon was in the lead and was soon some 100 yards west of the creek. Henry Herrick's second platoon crossed the dry creek and moved through the scrub brush on the right and slightly to the rear of Devney. Galen Bungum could hear scattered rifle shots up ahead as we moved out. Bungum says, "While we were headed that way, Sergeant Palmer came up behind me, put his arm around me, and said, 'Bungum, I'll be 40 years old day after tomorrow, and I don't believe I will live to see it.'" I didn't know how to answer Palmer, so I just said, "Come on, Sarge. You can't be out here with that kind of attitude. You'll make it." It was the third time in recent days that Carl Palmer had predicted his own death. Sergeant Larry Gilreath and Captain Heron say they, too, had similar conversations with Palmer and tried to reassure him. By 12:45 p.m., the contact had grown to a moderate firefight, and we were taking casualties. As fast as the fight was growing, I figured that we were in for a long afternoon and that the number of wounded might well exceed the capability of the platoon medics on the ground. Now I radioed Matt Dillon, who was back overhead in the command chopper, and told him to order the battalion surgeon, Captain Robert Carrara, and his medical aid station people to come into LZ X-ray. "Tell them not to bother with the tent, but bring a lot of supplies," I said. Things were definitely heating up for Al Devney's men at the point of the spear. Sergeant Gilreath recalls, "My third squad leader, Staff Sergeant Carl R. Burton, spotted a column of troops coming down the mountain. They didn't look like they were in any big hurry, walking along in single file. Some had their weapons on their shoulders. I don't think they knew exactly where we were. We checked with Captain Heron to make sure there were no South Vietnamese units in the area. Then we opened up on them. We had no knowledge of what size unit we were tangling with, but we found out very shortly when we were taken under heavy small arms fire and automatic weapons fire. At that time, I lost contact with Lieutenant Devney and was mainly concerned with placing the men closest to me in positions where they could return effective fire." Within minutes, Devney's first platoon, which was leading the assault, was attacked heavily by 30 to 40 North Vietnamese in khaki uniforms, wearing pith helmets and firing automatic weapons. It was now near 1 p.m. Devney's men were under attack on both flanks, and they were in trouble. The North Vietnamese were using a well-worn trail as a general axis of advance. Says Sergeant Gilreath, "We were virtually pinned to the ground and taking casualties." Lieutenant Dennis Deal remembers that moment. "Devney's platoon was taking moderate fire. We could all hear it through the foliage, and I heard it crackling on my radio. Al was in some sort of trouble. The firing increased in volume and intensity. Then I saw my first wounded trooper, probably the first American wounded in LZ X-ray. He was shot in the neck or mouth or both, was still carrying his rifle, was ambulatory and appeared stunned at what had happened to him. When he asked where to go, I put my arm around him and pointed to where I had last seen the battalion commander." Here's what Sergeant Jimmy Jakes of Phoenix City, Alabama, who was leading four men in one of Devney's rifle squads, remembers. "As we were advancing toward the enemy, two of my men and one from another squad were hit by machine gun fire. I was ordering men to my left and right. Some didn't even belong to our platoon. I yelled to them to lay down a base of fire. Then I crawled to aid the wounded. I was able to drag two of the wounded back to our defensive line. We had stopped advancing at this point. As I attempted to drag a third back, I was wounded. An AK-47 round penetrated Jakes's side and exited through the top of his left shoulder. Over on my right and slightly behind Al Devney's men, Lieutenant Henry T. Herrick was maneuvering his 2nd platoon up the slope toward a meeting with Destiny. His company commander, Captain Heron, said, "Herrick's platoon was probably my most seasoned unit, with outstanding NCOs. They were led by an old pro, SFC Sergeant First Class Carl Palmer, who I relied on to counsel and help develop Lieutenant Herrick, much as I did with my other two platoon sergeants, Larry Gilreath of the 1st platoon and Larry Williams of the 3rd. But the 2nd platoon had other NCOs who were exceptional. Ernie Savage, a young buck sergeant from Alabama, was a rifle squad leader. Then there was SFC Emmanuel Ranger Mac McHenry, who was 40 years old but could walk the legs off men half his age. Staff Sergeant Paul Hurdle, the weapons squad leader, who was a Korean War veteran, and Sergeant Reuben Thompson, a fire team leader with a reputation of never quitting. Henry Toro Herrick was red-haired, 5'10", 24 years old, and the son of an astronomy professor at UCLA. He had joined the battalion in July and had been given a rifle platoon. He was a hard charger. When the battalion recon platoon leader job, a coveted assignment, came open in October, I briefly entertained the notion of giving it to young Herrick. I mentioned Herrick to Sergeant Major Plumley, and his response was forceful and swift. "Colonel, if you put Lieutenant Herrick in there, he will get them all killed." We had a gaggle of new second lieutenants in the battalion, and it surprised me that one of them had made such a poor impression on the sergeant major. Herrick, needless to say, did not get the recon platoon job. Herrick's platoon sergeant, Carl Palmer, had voiced his own reservations about the lieutenant to Captain Heron after one of his men was drowned in a river crossing while on patrol. Sergeant Palmer took me aside after the drowning incident and told me that Herrick would get them all killed with his aggressiveness. Heron says, "But I couldn't fault Herrick for that. We were all eager to find the enemy, and I figured I could control his impetuous actions." Devney reported by radio to Captain Heron that his platoon was pinned down on both flanks. Says Heron, "I directed Lieutenant Herrick to alleviate some of the pressure, ordering him to move up on Devney's right and gain contact with Devney's 1st platoon. The time was now about 1:15 p.m., and the scrub brush was baking in the 90-plus degree heat of midday. A few rounds of enemy 60-millimeter and 82-millimeter mortars and some RPG-2 rocket-propelled grenades were bursting in Devney's area. Captain Heron and Lieutenant Bill Riddle, his artillery forward observer, now began working the radios, calling in air and artillery fire support. Devney's platoon sergeant, Larry Gilreath, was expecting to see Herrick and his men moving up on his right. He did, but not for long. As he moved, Herrick radioed Captain Heron to report that his 2nd platoon was taking fire from the right, that he had seen a squad of enemy soldiers and was pursuing them. Heron radioed back, "Fine, but be careful. I don't want you to get pinned down or sucked into anything." Gilreath says, "I saw Lieutenant Herrick at a distance of about 50 yards. His weapons squad leader, Sergeant Hurdle, was closest to me. I asked him, 'Where the hell are you going?' They were deployed on line and moving fast. I wanted him to stop and set up his 2 machine guns on my right flank. They kept on moving. I thought they were going to tie in with my men." Captain Heron was concerned about Devney's situation, but enthusiastic about Herrick's contact, which he reported to me by radio. Shortly after, Heron says, "I moved out again to catch up with Devney. He reported he was under heavy fire and pinned down. I immediately called Lieutenant Deal to move around to the left and help Devney." Dennis Deal had been running the 3rd Platoon Bravo Company for only 2 weeks. My platoon sergeant was Staff Sergeant Leroy Williams, a true man. He had spent a year and a half in Korea. My weapons squad leader was Staff Sergeant Wilbur Curry, a full-blooded Seneca Indian from upstate New York who was in Korea for 2 years and was reputed to be the best machine gunner in the battalion, if not the division. Just before we left base camp, Curry got too much fire water in him, got a horse from a Vietnamese, and rode up Route 19 toward Pleiku. Because Colonel Moore knew what a good trooper he really was, he passed on punishing Curry. Until now, Deal's platoon had not seen any enemy, but as they moved up 50 yards and approached Devney's left flank, they came under heavy fire. Sergeant Gilreath remembers seeing the 3rd Platoon having the same problems we were having with enemy automatic weapons fire. It was coming from a covered machine gun position, and it was giving us fits. Staff Sergeant William N. Rowland, a 22-year-old career soldier who came from Andrews, South Carolina, was one of Deal's squad leaders. We began to encounter wounded soldiers from the 1st Platoon. Then we started taking enemy fire, including incoming mortar rounds. Lieutenant Deal says, "My personal baptism of fire was occurring, and I turned around to Sergeant Curry. Chief, I've never been shot at before. Is this what it sounds like?" And he smiled. "Yes, sir, this is what it sounds like. We are being shot at." We had to scream at each other to be heard. The military historian S.L.A. Marshall wrote that at the beginning of a battle, units fractionalize, groping between the antagonists takes place, and the battle takes form from all this. Marshall had it right. That is precisely what was happening up in the scrub brush above Landing Zone X-ray this day. And no other single event would have a greater impact on the shape of this battle than what Lieutenant Henry Herrick was in the process of doing. Herrick charged right past Lieutenant Devney's men, swung his platoon to the right in hot pursuit of a few fleeing enemy soldiers, and disappeared from sight into the brush. Says Sergeant Ernie Savage of Herrick's orders, "He made a bad decision, and we knew at the time it was a bad decision. We were breaking contact with the rest of the company. We were supposed to come up on the flank of the 1st Platoon. In fact, we were moving away from them. We lost contact with everybody." Henry Herrick was in the lead with Sergeant McHenry's rifle squad as the platoon rushed through the brush, chasing the fleeing enemy down a gentle slope to the northwest on a well-beaten jungle path. His platoon was strung out over 50 yards. McHenry's squad was followed by Sergeant Jerry Zallin's rifle squad, and then came Ernie Savage's men. Paul Hurdle's weapons squad with its two M60 machine guns brought up the rear. The enemy quickly disappeared, but Herrick continued down the trail. He had put more than 100 yards between himself and the rest of Bravo Company when the path crossed a small steam bed 4 feet deep. Herrick crossed it with McHenry's squad and called for the rest of the platoon to follow. The foliage was thick near the stream, but opened up again only 5 yards out. The platoon closed up, and the two lead rifle squads came up on line, with McHenry on the right, Zallin on the left, and Savage and Hurdle in the rear. A small ridge line, hardly more than a finger, sloped down from a small rise of ground to the west, parallel to the stream bed and directly across the line of march of the two lead rifle squads. Captain Heron says, "In a few minutes, Herrick reported that he had reached a clearing and asked if he should go through it or around it. He said if he went around, he would lose contact with Al Devney. The fact is, Herrick had already lost contact with the 1st Platoon. He pressed on up the south side of the finger as the two squads in the rear were crossing the stream. At the top of that finger, the two lead squads suddenly collided with 40 or 50 North Vietnamese who were rushing down the trail toward the sound of the Bravo Company firefight. Both sides opened fire immediately, and the enemy broke both left and right. A huge termite hill was between Herrick's two lead squads when the shooting started. Herrick radioed to Savage, signaling him to flank the enemy from the right. With Hurdle's machine guns right behind, Savage and his troops did just that, charging out of the trees while firing their M16s on full automatic. The enemy were surprised by the flanking charge. Many of them spun or staggered and dropped, lashed by a hail of rifle fire and M79 grenades from Specialist 4 Robert M. Hill's launcher. Hill pumped grenade after grenade into the screaming Vietnamese. Firing raged from both sides, but suddenly, a larger group of 50 or more enemy scrambled out of the trees, attacked toward the termite hill, and were brought under heavy fire by the two squads on the finger and by Savage's squad on the right. An enemy machine gun and its 3-man crew were taken out during this fight. Says Savage, "We had one hell of a firefight for 3 or 4 minutes, and we hadn't lost anyone. We killed a lot of them. I hit a lot of them. I saw them fall. They tried to put a machine gun up on our right, and we shot the gunner and 2 men with him." On the radio to Captain Heron, Henry Herrick reported that he had enemy on his right and left flanks and was afraid of being cut off. Heron says, "I told him to try and reestablish contact with the 1st Platoon and move back in my direction. Simultaneously, I alerted 1st Platoon and told them to see if they could get to Herrick. It seemed like only a few minutes before Herrick was calling again, saying he had a large enemy force between him and Devney, was under intense fire, and was taking casualties. I told him to grab some terrain and hold, that we would get to him. I also told him to use mortar and artillery support. Bringing up the rear of Herrick's column, the old Korean War vet and machine gun wizard, Paul Hurdle, took in all that was happening at a glance and realized that both McHenry's and Savage's squads had their hands full and needed immediate help. Waving to his crews to follow, Hurdle charged out of the heavy vegetation near the stream, slammed both M60 machine guns down into firing positions aimed over the crest of the finger behind Savage's squad, and opened fire. Down below in the clearing, I heard the shocking uproar explode up on the mountainside. There were the steady, deep-throated bursts of machine gun fire, rifles crackling on full automatic, grenade, mortar, and rocket explosions. All of it was much louder and much more widespread than anything we'd experienced thus far. Now John Herron was up on my radio reporting that his men were under heavy attack by at least 2 enemy companies, and that a 2nd platoon was in danger of being surrounded and cut off from the rest of the company. Even as he spoke, mortar and rocket rounds hit in the clearing where I stood. My worst-case scenario had just come to pass. We were in heavy contact before all my battalion was on the ground. And now I had to deal with cut-off platoon. My response was an angry shit. Captain John Herron's estimate that his Bravo Company men were trying to deal with 2 enemy companies was slightly off. 1 full enemy battalion, more than 500 determined soldiers, was boiling down the mountain toward Herrick's trapped 2nd platoon and maneuvering near Al Devney's pinned-down 1st platoon. Bravo Company had gone into the fight with 5 officers and 114 enlisted men. In the swirling kaleidoscope of a fast-developing battle, John Herron was trying desperately to get a handle on what the enemy was doing, to keep me informed, and at the same time, to keep his company from being overrun. What was happening with Bravo Company intensified my concern about that dry creek bed approach into the western edge of the landing zone. My instincts told me that the enemy commander was likely to strike on our left flank, heading for the clearing. We needed help fast, and help was on the way. Old Snake, Bruce Crandall, came up on the radio. Having been delayed by the need to refuel his 16 ships, he was inbound on the 4th lift of the day with the last few men of Tony Nadal's Alpha Company and the lead elements of Captain Bob Edwards's Charlie Company troops. As the first aid choppers dropped into the clearing at 1:32 p.m., I told Captain Nadal to collect his men and move up fast on John Herron's left to tie in with him. Then I said, "I want you to lend Herron a platoon to help him get to his cutoff platoon." I ran out into the clearing to locate Bob Edwards. I had decided to commit Charlie Company toward the mountain as fast as they arrived and take the risk of leaving my rear unguarded from the north and east. There would be no battalion reserve for a while. Captain Edwards' men of Charlie Company jumped off their choppers and ran for the wooded edge of the landing zone, the southern edge, thank God. I grabbed Edwards, gave him a quick briefing, and then yelled at him to run his men off the landing zone to the south and southwest and take up a blocking position protecting Alpha Company's left flank. I screamed, "Move!" and Edwards and his 2 radio operators shot off at a dead run, yelling and waving to the rest of the men to follow. Bob Edwards says, "While organizing the blocking position, we received heavy sniper fire, mainly small arms and a few automatic weapons. Then 15 or 20 minutes after landing, we received sporadic mortar or rocket fire. We had not yet made contact with enemy foot troops. After getting into the trees, I disposed my 3 rifle platoons on line, 3rd platoon on the right, 1st platoon in the center, 2nd platoon on the left. My command post was just off the edge of the landing zone, close to the rear of Lieutenant Jack Gagan's 2nd platoon. A combination of luck, rapid reaction to orders, and trained, disciplined soldiers doing what they were told enabled the company to rapidly establish a hasty line of defense 50 to 100 yards off the landing zone. The elephant grass was a problem. When you went to ground, your visibility was extremely limited. By now, my radio operator, Bob Ouellette, and I had rejoined Sergeant Major Plumley and Captain Tom Metzger near the dry creek bed. The interpreter, Mr. Nick, had gone to ground. Captain Metzger dropped to one knee and began firing his M16 at enemy soldiers out in the open, just 75 yards to the south. Within minutes, Metzger suffered a gunshot wound in his shoulder, was bandaged by First Sergeant Arthur J. Newton of Alpha Company, and was sent back to the cops. I was tempted to join Nadal's or Edwards' men, but resisted the temptation. I had no business getting involved with the actions of only one company. I might get pinned down and become simply another rifleman. My duty was to lead riflemen. Just now, the snaps and cracks of the rounds passing nearby took on a distinctly different sound, like a swarm of bees around our heads. I was on the radio, trying to hear a transmission over the noise, when I felt a firm hand on my right shoulder. It was Sergeant Major Plumley's. He shouted over the racket of the firefights, "Sir, if you don't find some cover, you're going to go down, and if you go down, we all go down." Plumley was right as always. Anyone waving, yelling, hand-signaling, or talking on a radio was instantly targeted by the enemy. These guys were quick to spot and shoot leaders, radio operators, and medics. I had never fretted about being wounded in combat, in Korea or here. But Plumley brought me up short. The game was just beginning. This was no time for me to go out of it. The sergeant major pointed to a large termite hill, 7 or 8 feet high, located in some trees in the waste between the two open areas of the landing zone. It was about 30 yards away. The three of us turned and ran toward it with bullets kicking up the red dirt around our feet and the bees still buzzing around our heads. That termite hill, the size of a large automobile, would become the battalion command post, the aid station, the supply point, the collection area for enemy prisoners, weapons and equipment, and the place where our dead were brought. Just now, at 1:38 p.m., the second wave of 8 choppers dropped in with more Alpha and Charlie Company troops. They picked up some ground fire this time. Edwards and Nadal sorted out their arriving soldiers and married them up with the respective companies. Tagging along with this lift was a medical evacuation helicopter bringing in my battalion and 8 station group. The big red cross painted on each side only drew more fire. On board were Captain Robert Carrara, the surgeon, Medical Platoon Sergeant Thomas Keaton, and Staff Sergeant Earl Keith. President Johnson sent us off to war shorthanded in many areas, but no shortages were so critical as those in medical personnel. The aid station was authorized 13 personnel. Keaton and Keith were all we had. Period. Captain Carrara and his 2 sergeants performed miracles for the next 50 hours. Sergeant Keaton describes their arrival. Between 1:30 and 1:45 p.m., we came in over X-ray trailing a flight of 4 helicopters, and you can see our soldiers in the North Vietnamese. The NVA were in the wood line shooting at the helicopter. The medevac pilot kind of froze up on us and was having trouble setting the ship down. We never did come to a complete hover. All aboard had to dive out on the ground from about 6 feet up in the air. We ran in a crouch over to where Colonel Moore was, near an anthill. There were 20 to 25 wounded there, all huddled on the ground. We put the dead over in a separate area and started to work. There were now about 250 men of my battalion on the ground and still functioning. Casualties were beginning to pile up. As we dropped behind that termite hill, I fleetingly thought about an illustrious predecessor of mine in the 7th Cavalry, Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer, and his final stand in the Valley of the Little Bighorn in Montana 89 years earlier. I was determined that history would not repeat itself in the Valley of the Iadrang. We were a tight, well-trained, and disciplined fighting force, and we had one thing George Custer did not have: fire support. Now was the time to pull the chain on everything I could lay hands on. I radioed Matt Dillon, the fire support coordinators overhead, and told them to bring in airstrikes, artillery, and aerial rocket artillery on the lower part of the mountain, especially on the approaches to the landing zone from the west and south. Priority for all fires was to go to specific requests from the infantry companies. When not firing those missions, the other targets should be hit continuously. I told Dylan and the others to keep their eyes peeled for any enemy mortar positions. I hoped the air and artillery would take some of the pressure off my troops, as well as cut up enemy reinforcements headed down the mountain for the fight. Within minutes, the air in the valley was filled with smoke and red dust as a blessed river of high-power destruction rained from the skies. The company commanders and the mortar and artillery forward observers, however, were all having trouble getting an accurate fix on the locations of their forward elements. Colonel Tim Brown, overhead in his command chopper, came up on my radio and urged me to pull the fires off the mountain and bring them in as close as possible. John Heron had the biggest problem. Trying to pinpoint the location of his missing 2nd platoon, Herrick and his men were not only separated from the rest of Bravo Company, but also engaged in a moving firefight. The fact that this platoon was out in front of Nadal and Heron delayed effective delivery of close-in artillery fire for some time. But by walking the fires back down the mountain, the company commanders managed to place some of the artillery where it would do some good. And the torrent of supporting fire farther up the mountain slopes was chopping up enemy reinforcements. This cannonade was awesome to see, and its thunder was a symphony to our ears. The artillery rounds hissed over our heads with the characteristic sound of incoming, followed by visible detonations nearby. The ARA helicopters wheeled in over X-ray and with a whoosh unleashed their 2.75-inch rockets, which detonated with shattering blasts. The Air Force fighter bombers roared across the sky, dropping 250 and 500-pound bombs and fearsome napalm canisters. Throughout, there was the constant close-in noise of rifles, machine guns, and exploding grenades and mortar shells. It was now becoming clear that the large open area south of the Termite Hill command post, where the helicopters had been landing, was especially vulnerable. This was the biggest open area, but it was also closest to where the enemy was attacking. I had been eyeing a smaller clearing just east of my command post that could take 2 helicopters at a time if some trees were removed. This would be our supply and evacuation link to the rear if the landing zone got much hotter. I turned to my demolition team leader, Sergeant George Nye of the 8th Engineer Battalion, and told him to get those trees down. Nye, a 25-year-old native of Bangor, Maine, had led 6 men into X-ray. Specialist 5 James Clark, Specialist 5 Scott O'Henry, Specialist 4 Robert Dursch, PFC Jimmy D. Nakayama, PFC Melvin Allen, and PFC David Wilson. All of a sudden, the fire became heavier and heavier, and the perimeter just seemed to erupt into a melee of constant fire, Nye recalls. You could see the enemy, and suddenly we were part of the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry. It's tough to try to be an infantryman and a demolition specialist at the same time, but we did it. We blew those trees no sawing. The intensity of fire made working with a saw tough, working without a weapon. By blowing the trees, we could spend more time fighting. I heard that one of our people had got killed, a kid named Henry, Specialist Henry of Columbus, Georgia. As the day drew on, I found out we did lose Henry. During the few minutes I had been involved with Charlie Company's move to the south, and on the radio bringing in fire support, and talking to George Nye about clearing that little landing zone, Captain Tony Nadal had begun moving his Alpha Company troopers southwest across the open ground toward the dry creek bed. Chapter 7. Closing with the Enemy. If your officer's dead and the sergeants look white, remember it's ruin to run from a fight. So take open order, lie down and sit tight, and wait for supports like a soldier. Rudyard Kipling, The Young British Soldier. Lieutenant Robert E. Taft was leading the 3rd platoon of Alpha Company at a lope toward the sound of battle. He had gotten orders to move from the company commander, Captain Tony Nadal, and he was carrying them out. Lean, boyish, just 23 years old, Bob Taft of Highland Park, Illinois, was setting a pace toward the tree line at the edge of the clearing that his heavily laden radio operator Specialist 4 Robert Hazen, also 23 and a Chicagoan, had trouble matching. Hazen was carrying his M16 rifle, a bundle of ammunition, and the big PRC-25 field radio strapped to his back. Captain Nadal was moving two of his platoons toward the dry creek bed in order to secure that critical piece of terrain, as well as to protect the left flank of Bravo Company, as I had ordered. Nadal says, "I was just east of the creek bed, walking through elephant grass, when suddenly there's my West Point classmate John Herron laying on the ground with his radio operators. He looked up and told me, 'Lots of VC up there.' Herron also remembers that chance meeting. I told him to get down or get his ass shot off. Nadal got down." Farther out in the scrub brush, John Herron's 1st and 3rd platoons were linking up and moving out to try to reach Lieutenant Henry Herrick's embattled platoon. Nadal had loaned his 2nd platoon, led by Lieutenant Walter J. Joe Marm, to Herron for this attack. There had been a delay in getting Marm's men online and oriented, and Deal and Devney had already kicked off their attack. Marm was about 100 yards behind Herron's 2 platoons. Lieutenant Deal recalls what happened next. "I'm on my left and Devney on the right, out of physical contact with company headquarters. Both platoons advanced toward Herrick and were met with automatic weapons and small arms fire, causing light to moderate casualties in both platoons. Intense fire caused a withdrawal to a position where we could evaluate the situation." At that moment, Lieutenant Bob Taft and his 3rd platoon of Alpha Company collided head-on with an enemy force of about 150 men charging down and along both sides of the dry creek. A savage fight now broke out over ownership of the creek bed. Captain Nadal, who had spent a year in South Vietnam with the Special Forces, looked out across the creek bed at the enemy boiling out of the trees and knew these were not Viet Cong guerrillas, but North Vietnamese regulars. He got on the battalion net radio and yelled, "They're PAVN! They're PAVN!" Specialist 4 Carmen Michelli, a native of North Bergen, New Jersey, remembers, "We were told to drop our packs. We got online and moved forward in the attack. I saw Specialist 4 Bill Beck on an M60 machine gun out to my left. Captain Nadal was right there with us. We took fire and guys started going down. We could see the enemy very plainly. We were assaulting. A lot of our guys were hit right away." Sergeant Steve Hansen was behind and to the right of Lieutenant Taft. He says, "We moved at a trot across the open grass toward the tree line and heard fire up on the finger to the west where we were headed. My radio operator friend Specialist 4 Ray Tanner and I crossed the stream bed. Captain Nadal's party and the 2 other platoons were off to the right. Lieutenant Taft was well forward as we crossed over into the trees. SFC Lorenzo Nathan, Ray Tanner, and I were close, maybe 10 yards behind. We were moving fast. Specialist 4 Pete Winter was near me. We ran into a wall of lead. Every man in the lead squad was shot. From the time we got the order to move to the time where men were dying was only 5 minutes. The enemy were very close to us and overran some of our dead. The firing was heavy. Sergeant Nathan pulled us back out of the woods to the stream bed." Bob Hazen, Bob Taft's radio operator, recalls, "Lieutenant Taft got out in front of me. I was off to his left. He had the radio handset in his left hand connected to the radio on my back with that flexible rubber wire. It got tight, and I pulled back on the lieutenant and hollered, 'We're getting offline.' He glanced back at me, turned back to his front, and took 4 more steps. Then he fired 2 shots at something. I couldn't see what. Then he dropped face down on the ground. Lieutenant Taft was hit. I didn't realize how bad till I rolled him over. He was shot in the throat, and the round had ricocheted down and came out his left side. He was dead, and it was difficult to roll him over, even though he was a slightly built man." Captain Nadal says, "The enemy on the mountain started moving down rapidly in somewhat uncoordinated attacks. They streamed down the hill and down the creek bed. The enemy knew the area. They came down the best covered route. The 3rd platoon was heavily engaged and the volume of firing reached a crescendo on my left. At this time, I lost radio contact with Taft's platoon." In the center of that fury, Bob Hazen struggled and rolled his dead platoon leader over. He was gone and there was nothing we could do. The first thing I thought of was what they taught me. Never let the enemy get his hands on a map or the signals codebook. I got those from Lieutenant Taft and was kneeling over to try to pull his body back. That's when my radio was hit, and the shrapnel from the radio hit me in the back of the head. It didn't really hurt. All of a sudden, I was just laying face down on the ground next to Lieutenant Taft. I felt something running down my neck, reached back, and came out with a handful of blood. Carmen Michelli was on Hazen's right. We knew what had happened. The word passed fast. They got Lieutenant Taft. Lieutenant Wayne O. Johnson's 1st Platoon of Alpha Company was just to the right of Taft's men. Johnson's platoon sergeant, Sergeant 1st Class Troy Miller, recalls, "We could see the enemy go after the 3rd Platoon like crazy. It was a more exposed area than we were in, and the North Vietnamese had a better covered and better concealed route into them. The enemy was well camouflaged, and you can barely see them because their khaki uniform and hats of the same color blended in well with the brownish-yellow grass. They all seemed very well disciplined and did not seem to have any fear of dying at all. This was a very critical time. Whichever side owned that dry creek bed, with its cover and concealment, owned the open area where the Hueys were landing. We had to hold that creek bed, and it had come down to Nadal and his men to do it, face to face with a very aggressive enemy. Like every other unit in the battalion, the 3rd Platoon's weapons squad was under strength. It had two M60 machine gun teams, each authorized a gunner, an assistant gunner, and two ammunition bearers. In reality, one team was down to three men, the other to only two. One team consisted of the gunner specialist for Russell E. Adams, 23, of Shoemakersville, Pennsylvania, assistant gunner specialist for Bill Beck, 22, of Steelton, Pennsylvania, and ammunition carrier PFC John Wonderly. Russell Adams was exactly 14 days short of completing his Army obligation when he landed in X-ray. At 5 feet 8 inches tall and 145 pounds, Adams was small but wiry. He handled the heavy M60 machine gun with ease. Beck was 6'2", lean and hard. The other M60 crew was made up of specialist for Theron Ladner, 22, a tall, thin native of Biloxi, Mississippi, and his assistant gunner, PFC Rodriguez E. Rivera. Bill Beck says Russell Adams was his best buddy, a calm, soft-spoken man with big hands. He didn't talk much, never bitched, just oiled his M60. Beck says, adding, "We moved toward the creek bed after chow. Suddenly fire was everywhere, and Jerry Kirsch, 3 yards directly in front of me, got hit with machine gun fire and dropped screaming, rolling on his back, yelling for his mother. That scared the shit out of me, and I jumped to the left for cover beside a soldier on the ground. He was in a firing position and looking at me. It was Sergeant Alexander Williams. He had a small hole in his forehead and he was dead. Williams, 24, was from Jacksonville, Florida. Beck says, "I jumped up as fast as I jumped down and ran forward toward Adams, who had gone past Kirsch. We were in the open about 30 yards left of the creek bed, moving parallel to it toward Chu Pong. Nobody had told us how far to go, so we kept moving. I heard Bob Hazen yelling about Lieutenant Taft getting hit. I saw him leaning over Taft when an NVA blasted him and his radio exploded into pieces. His back was to the creek bed. That all happened at once, you know, 30 seconds. We kept moving. Adams firing from the hip blew away an NVA aiming his AK at us through the fork of a tree. Over on the east side of the creek, Bob Hazen lay, briefly unconscious, beside his dead lieutenant. When he came to, he helped drag Taft's body back to the creek bed. We were under fire. I looked over to our right and behind us was an NVA leaning up against the tree facing it, the tree. We had bypassed him. The medic and I saw him up tight against that tree, pith helmet on, tan uniform, pistol belt, and a weapon. I didn't have a weapon. He looked over at us. Then somebody on my left shot him. He slammed into that tree real hard and then just crumpled. That NVA soldier could well have been the man who had done a lot of damage to Nadal's 3rd Platoon. Dead were Lieutenant Taft, Sergeant Travis Poss, Specialist 4 Albert Witcher, and Sergeant Alexander Williams. Several men were wounded, including the platoon radio operator Bob Hazen, whose PRC-25 radio had been shot to pieces. Survivors, dragging their wounded comrades, pulled back to the creek bed. Although they had been hit hard and had suffered several casualties, Taft's platoon, now led by Korean War veteran Sergeant Lorenzo Nathan, stood firm and stopped the momentum of the attack. The enemy recoiled and slowly drifted off to their left, still trying to find a way to flank Bravo Company. This brought them directly in front of Joe Marm's troopers, who had been moving up to join Bravo. About 80 North Vietnamese soldiers were caught by surprise as Marm's troopers opened up with volley after volley of grazing point-blank machine gun and rifle fire and heaved hand grenades into their packed ranks on their exposed right flank. Marm's men mowed them down. Two enemy were taken prisoner. Several of the men still remember the curious behavior of the North Vietnamese who came under this murderous fire. Captain Tony Nadal says, "It wasn't much of a fight. The second platoon just mowed them down." Staff Sergeant Les Staley recalls, "50 NVA came right across my front and were cut down almost immediately, and they did not turn and try to return our fire." The enemy survivors fell back to their right rear toward the creek bed. That brought them back in front of Tony Nadal's 1st and 3rd platoons, which were now in the 4-foot-deep cover of the creek bed. Again, the enemy were cut down by close-range flanking fire from their right. They just kept walking into the field of fire. Sergeant Troy Miller of the 1st platoon was in the thick of it. "I saw one NVA in the creek bed hit in the upper part of his body, killed by a sergeant from 3rd platoon and a team leader from my platoon. He was no more than 10 feet away. We searched his body later and found he had taken Lieutenant Taft's dog tags." Captain Nadal, out of radio contact with Taft's platoon, moved toward the furious firing on his left flank to find out what was happening. Nadal says, "My radio operator, Sergeant Jackie Gell, the company communications chief who had volunteered to carry one of my two radios, ran with me out of the creek bed into the open area toward Taft's position. We ran into Sergeant Nathan and I asked him what was happening. He said the platoon had been attacked on the left flank. The left squad had taken a number of casualties and had pulled back out of the creek bed, refusing their left flank to the enemy. Nathan said Taft had been hit and was left in the creek bed. That made me angry. We had been taught never to leave any wounded or dead in the battlefield. Sergeant Gell and I crawled forward on our lines to that creek bed, where the enemy were, to find Taft. We came under grenade attack from the west side of the creek bed, but had some cover from a few trees. We located Taft dead. While bringing him back, we saw another soldier who had been left behind. After leaving Taft's body with his platoon, Gell and I went back again and we picked up the other man." Bill Beck and Russell Adams had by now moved about 100 yards toward the mountain and were heavily engaged with masses of enemy 30 yards to their south and west around the creek bed. Beck says their charge into battle had been eventful. "As I was chasing after Adams, above the noise of automatic fire, someone yelled grenade, and right in front of me, less than 2 yards away, one of those wooden-handled potato masher hand grenades rolled to a stop. I started to go to ground, my knees bent. Then came an explosion and flash of bright white light. I never did hit the ground and continued to move, carrying my boxes of M60 ammo. On the right, 20 yards away, was an anthill with a clump of trees on it, just outside the creek bed. American GIs were on one side and two NVA soldiers were on the other side, not 5 yards away from each other. I don't think our men could see the enemy. I yelled at the top of my lungs, but nobody could hear me because of the overall noise of battle. It was deafening. The only weapon I had was my .45 caliber pistol." Beck says, "All this time I had been jumping, dodging, hitting the dirt, and moving forward with Adams. Now I pulled my .45 and fired the entire clip of 7 rounds at the left side of that anthill, and both of the enemy dropped. Adams called for ammo, and I moved up with him beside a little tree. We were now the forwardmost position. I was feeding belt after belt of 7.62-millimeter ammunition into the gun. We were prone, and he was firing at the enemy in front and to the right. On the right, about 10 yards out, were our buddies, Theron Ladner and Rodriguez Rivera, on their gun. We could hardly see them in the grass. Beck adds, I would spot movement to the front point where, and Adams did the firing. This went on for several attacks. The enemy were zeroed in on Russ and me, their bullets hitting the tree trunk, the dirt around us, and crackling over our heads. Russ stopped those assaults, and we started looking for our ammo bearer, John Wunderly. He was gone. I can remember the extreme heat and exhaustion taking hold now, like I hadn't taken a breath the entire time. We were soaked with sweat, and the sun was very hot as we lay in the brown grass in the open, with really no cover but the grass. On one of his trips up to collect Taft and the wounded soldier, Captain Adal spotted Beck and Adams on his left about 20 yards out and running toward the mountain. Beck and his gunner Russell Adams and the other M60 crew ended up at least 75 yards out front of Alpha Company's 3rd Platoon. Adams put it simply, "Nobody told me to stop, so I kept going." In piecing together the mosaic of a confused and fast-paced fight, it is clear to me that those courageous machine gunners inflicted heavy casualties on a large North Vietnamese force that was hurrying down to reinforce the attack on Alpha Company's left flank. Bill Beck and his buddies paid a terrible price. But virtually single-handedly, they kept the enemy from turning Nadal's left flank and driving a wedge between Alpha and Charlie Companies. Overhead, some of the best air support work was being done by the A-1E Sky Raider, an antiquated single-engine propeller plane of Korean War vintage that proved a great worth providing tactical air support to ground troops. It was slow but heavily armored and simply built. It delivered very accurate fire and, best of all, could hang around for up to 8 hours. Captain Bruce M. Wallace, an enlisted man in the Korean War and a 1956 West Point graduate, was on a second Vietnam tour with the Air Force in 1965, this time flying the old SPADs, as the A-1Es were nicknamed. Says Wallace, "The Sky Raider was uniquely suited for putting ordnance on the ground at the exact time and in the precise place that the ground commander needed it. It was slow, cumbersome, ungainly, greasy, and hot to fly. But you could hang everything under its wings but the kitchen sink." As fighting intensified around the Ia Drang, all available aircraft and crews of the 1st and 602nd Air Commando Squadrons were committed to the mission. At around 2 p.m., one of those A-1Es was coming in from the south, just above the slope of the mountain, very low, just over the trees, on a bombing run directly over the location where the enemy was attacking from. Suddenly there was an explosion, and the SPAD burst into flames. It continued on down the creek bed, trailing fire and smoke, passed directly over us and the fighting, turned back east, and staggered on for perhaps 2 miles before crashing in a black ball of smoke. We saw no parachute. Overhead, Captain Matt Dillon in the command ship had a clear view. The plane caught fire, veered off, and crashed to the east of X-ray. There was an explosion and fire. We flew over to see if we could see any sign of life. Very soon after the crash, a lot of enemy, 20 or 30 of them, came running to the plane. I called the aerial rocket ships in on them. Air Force records indicate that the pilot who died in that crash was Captain Paul T. McClellan, Jr., 34, of West Staten, Oregon, who flew for the 1st Air Commando Squadron. Captain Bruce Wallace says, "Paul was probably downed by fragments of his own ordnance. We were carrying both bombs and napalm on a single aircraft, and safe separation altitudes for the two types of ordnance were different." It was easy to select the wrong switch in the cockpit during the heat of a low-altitude mission under fire. The precise cause of that crash, however, was never officially determined. Meanwhile, back at 3rd Brigade Headquarters, Brigadier General Dick Knowles had been filled in on details of our rapidly developing fight. The prisoner we captured had been debriefed. He identified his unit as a battalion of the 33rd Regiment of the People's Army. Intelligence said the 66th Regiment and the 320th Regiment were also in the vicinity. At Knowles' urging, the division commander, Major General Harry Kennard, flew in from headquarters at Angers for a briefing. Says Knowles, "When General Kennard arrived, I showed him a situation map. He took one look and said, 'What the hell are you doing in that area?' I replied, 'Well, General, the object of the exercise is to find the enemy, and we sure as hell have.' After an awkward pause and a few questions, he said, 'Okay, it looks great. Let me know what you need.'" While all of this was taking place, John Herron was still desperately trying to reach Lieutenant Herrick's cutoff platoon. His other platoons were battling a large number of enemy who had moved between them and Herrick. During the confusion, Lieutenant Bill Riddle, Herron's artillery forward observer, made his way forward and linked up with Lieutenant Al Devney. Herron was still in the creekbed area, to the right of Nadal's Alpha Company location, trying to get Lieutenant Joe Marm's platoon of reinforcements linked up with Deal and Devney. The devastating flanking fire Nadal's Alpha Company soldiers poured on the enemy, and the shock of the continuing artillery and air bombardment, caused the North Vietnamese ahead of Devney and Deal to reel back and slack off. This gave Lieutenant Marm and his troops the opportunity to move forward and link up with the two Bravo Company platoons. Now they were able to launch a full three-platoon attack in the direction of Herrick's cutoff men. It was three platoons abreast, left to right, Deal, Devney, and Marm. Dennis Deal remembers, "We moved on line for about 100 or 150 yards before the volume of firing forced us to stop. We were taking too many casualties. I radioed Herrick's platoon and said, 'I think we are close to you. Shoot one round off, wait till the count of three and shoot two more.' The radio man or whoever was on the radio did that, so we had a pretty firm fix on where he was. We got up and started the assault again. We went about 10 yards and the whole thing just blew up in our faces. The enemy had infiltrated between Herrick's platoon and us, and now we're starting to come in behind us. I saw Platoon Sergeant Leroy Williams shoot into a tree. A weapon fell, but the body didn't. It was roped into the treetop. There were at least 15 of our men wounded and dead out front." At this point, our medic Specialist 5 Calvin Bonite rose from cover, ran over, and began administering aid to the wounded. He succeeded in treating four or five of them, always by placing his body between the continuous sheets of heavy fire and the man he was treating. Bonite was mortally wounded less than 5 minutes after he began performing his stunningly heroic acts. Bonite, 24, was from Washington, D.C. Deal says, "Suddenly a lull occurred on the battlefield. During that lull, one of the men in my platoon got up on his knees while the rest of us were all flat on our stomachs. He was promptly shot in the upper body 10 feet from me, and I heard the bullet strike human flesh. It sounded exactly like when you take a canoe paddle and slap it into mud. One bullet, one hit, another man down. During the same lull, my radio operator's hip suddenly exploded, if you will, and before the bleeding started, I saw white, jagged bone sticking out. We gave him first aid and tried to keep him out of shock. He said, 'I'll be all right, just show me where to go.' He made his own way back to the aid station." Lieutenant Deal adds that he and the other two platoon leaders now began playing yet another attempt to break through and rescue Herrick's men. Leaders were running back and forth coordinating this when all of a sudden firing began. The lull dissipated quickly. It was at this time that my weapon squad leader, Sergeant Curry, the chief, was killed. His last words were, "Those bastards are trying to get me." He was caught rolling around on the ground. Later on, as my men were carrying him back, I had them put him down and turned his face toward me and looked at him. I could not conceive of the chief being dead. Staff Sergeant Wilbur Curry, Jr. of Buffalo, New York, was 35 years old. Deal said his platoon and the others got up to launch the attack and again were driven back by extremely heavy fire. We slugged it out for all we were worth, but finally had so many wounded we had to stop and say, let's get out of here. Sergeant Larry Gilreath says, we tried fire and movement and online attack, but the NVA were waiting for us each time. Less than 100 yards away, Herrick's men were in a running gunfight for their lives, and had been from the first minute of contact. Shortly after Sergeant Ernie Savage cleaned up that enemy machine gun crew, he spotted movement out of the corner of his eye back toward the little creek. Turning in that direction, he saw a large group of fast-moving enemy. Savage says, there were 50, maybe 70 of them. They weren't firing on us. They were going around to our right, trying to get in behind us. We fired on them and kept firing to our front also. Then they outflanked us. There was no way we could control it with what we had. We were short on people. By now, Sergeant Paul Hurdle's two machine guns were firing on enemy to the front and to the right. Savage's squad was also fighting on two sides, 30 yards out front of the machine guns, and began withdrawing by fire and movement, one fire team shooting while the other fell back toward the rest of the second platoon on the lower end of the finger. Says Savage, the machine gunners were already set up on the lower part of the finger and firing. There was so much noise, I didn't know that at the time. When we started pulling back, I saw both gunners sitting there. They were firing just over the rise and downhill. We pulled back past the guns. PFC Bernard Bierenbaum was one of the gunners, and he damn sure did some damage before he went down. His firing allowed us to get back. We pulled straight back toward him. It was a wonder he didn't shoot us. The enemy were behind us, and he was firing past us. Things were going real fast. Herrick and the other two squads were holding precariously to the small knoll near the bottom of the finger. Savage teamed up with McHenry's squad, which was pinned to the ground. Herrick was with that squad. Sergeant Zollin's squad was to their left rear. Savage checked on his men when he tied up with McHenry. He knew that Specialist 4 Robert M. Hill, the M79 Grenadier, was no longer with them. Hill got killed in there somewhere. He had his M79 and a .45 pistol, and he was firing both at the same time. The 23-year-old Hill came from Starkville, Mississippi. Now the men of Herrick's three rifle squads were all grouped together on the small knoll under heavy fire from enemy troops close in on their north and east. Unfortunately, the two M60 machine gun crews were separated from them by a distance of about 30 yards downhill. As Savage began to deploy his men into firing positions, the North Vietnamese mounted a reinforced attack from three directions, up the finger from the north, down the finger from the southwest, and worst of all, 50 to 70 attackers coming from the ditch toward the rear of the two M60 machine guns. Lieutenant Herrick and Platoon Sergeant Carl Palmer were in the middle of the action. By now, Savage had personally killed 15 to 20 enemy. The machine guns were still firing, and we were all fighting as hard as we could to hold the enemy off. There were a lot of them all over, Savage recalls. Lieutenant Herrick shouted to the machine gun crews to come up the hill. One was out on the north end of the finger with Sergeant Hurdle. The other, closer in, disengaged and scrambled up the knoll and into the tiny American perimeter. Sergeant Hurdle's gun kept firing to cover the withdrawal. It came under attack by a large number of enemy who swarmed all around the crew. It was during this desperate melee that Herrick's platoon suffered its worst casualties and lost one of its precious machine guns. Sergeant Savage again. The enemy were past the machine gun before it ever quit firing. I could hear Sergeant Hurdle down there cursing. Even over the firefight I heard him. He was famous for that. Motherfucker, son of a bitch, I could hear him hollering that down there. Then they threw grenades in on him. Hurdle 36 was from Washington, D.C. Bierenbaum 24 was a native of New York City. PFC Donald Roddy, 22, hailed from Ann Arbor, Michigan. The three of them died in a hail of rifle fire and enemy grenades. As Sergeant Wayne M. Anderson and his assistant gunner made it up the finger, carrying the other